listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Pogranicze. Pogranicze jest cieniem rzuconym przez granicę na najbliższe sąsiedztwo. Powstaje w ten sposób strefa chroniąca zróżnicowanie, życiodajna. Inaczej niż strefa pasa przygranicznego, pusta, strzeżona i wroga. Pogranicze nie zaciera granicy, lecz rozszerza jej przestrzeń, oswaja zamieszkiwanie i przenikanie w jej strefie. Pogranicze jest agorą. Tutaj ten, który nie jest w dialogu z innym, wegetuje na peryferiach. Środek tej kuli znajduje się zawsze w spotkaniu, czyli wszędzie, a jej obwód w tym, co nietknięte innością, czyli nigdzie. Pogranicze odbiera granicy jej bezwzględność cienkiej linii, która w otwartej przestrzeni rozcina i dzieli, wyjaławiając wszystko w obszarze najbliższego sąsiedztwa. Kto mieszka w strefie granicy, ten bardziej myśli o jej przekraczaniu niż o powrocie do domu.
From the path of the borderland. The borderland is the shadow cast by the border on the nearest neighborhood. Therefore, a life-giving buffer zone takes shape, one protecting diversity. It differs from the usual kind of buffer zone, empty, guarded, and rife with enmity. The borderland does not erode the borders, but rather expands the sphere that they encompass, absorbing those who live there, accepting their intermingling as a matter of course. Borderland is an agora. Here, he who is not in dialogue with others simply vegetates on the periphery. The center of the sphere is always found in the meetings that take place there, and its circumference is found in that which remains untouched by otherness, in other words, nowhere. The borderland deprives the border itself of the ruthlessness inherent in a thin line that slices through open space and divides it, while at the same time rendering everything in its immediate vicinity barren. Anyone who lives in a border zone thinks more about crossing it than about going back. So we welcome you to our meeting here at Central Library, my dear guests and our audience. I want to welcome you. That was an excerpt from Path of the Borderlands by our guest, Krzysztof Krzyzewski, whom you'll hear from again shortly. I want to welcome you to a very special evening as part of Aloud from Tijuana to Gaza to Bosnia, looking at borders in a 21st century world. I'm Louise Steinman, the curator of the Aloud series, and tonight's special program is part of the International 2011 Miłosz Year Centennial, celebrating the birth of the Nobel Prize-winning Polish poet, Czesław Miłosz. So why do we celebrate this poet's life with a program about borders and borderlands? Because Miłosz himself was a man of the borderlands, son of the Polish-Lithuanian borderland, and Krzysztof Krzyzewski, who knew Miłosz very well, has traveled from that fabled region all the way from Poland, Saini, Poland, to tell us about his borderland foundation that honors Miłosz's memory. And Krzysztof also came to meet and share work with a quite special group of dedicated artists and scholars from Los Angeles, Arizona, Tijuana, who are also concerned in many different ways with issues about and the culture of borders. I think Miłosz would have really loved the idea that we were doing this here at the library, which is dedicated to free access to ideas and information, and he was certainly a free thinker. I think he would have been very much appreciative of being celebrated in a library. I also want to thank the Polish Ministry of Culture and National Heritage for funding this particular gathering. So now on to our program. This panel of writers, poets, scholars, visual artists, cultural activists. Yesterday we met for a full day at the Santa Monica Museum of Art, which we also thank for lending us a creative workspace, so that they could share their work with each other on border issues. So they are Krzysztof Czczewski to my left, publisher, director, and founder of the Borderland Foundation in Saini, Poland, celebrated visual artist Marcos Ramirez Ere from Tijuana, who is a longtime explicator and arbiter of the cross-border dialogue from Tijuana, Josh Kuhn, scholar, author, and director of the Popular Music Project at the Norman Lear Center, USC Annenberg, Dorit Sipis, award-winning visual artist and professional mediator, Ruben Martinez, whom you may have seen playing rock and roll on the stage before, author, teacher, performer, and professor of literature at Loyola Marymount, and Ofelia Zepeda, who is here from Tucson, who is a poet and Regents Professor of Linguistics at the University of Arizona, where she works on the Odum language, and you'll hear more about that later. So they're each going to give a brief presentation on their work and their personal orientation to border issues, and then we'll have a conversation among the panel. So yesterday we had a full day to share our work with each other. We talked about the tension between the border's life-giving power and its ruthlessness, and I have to let you in on a secret. We didn't come up with any grand solutions to the giant problems of the world. We didn't think we would. But we shared stories, both personal and historical, and we began what we hope will be an ongoing dialogue about the path, the borderland, which appears and disappears. And as Krzysztof points out, looking at systemic and chronic issues, it takes a lifetime of work, and these are some very dedicated people. So my job is to play the evil timekeeper to remind you all to try and keep on track so we can have time to hear you all. And now, Krzysztof, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Louise, for bringing me here to this circle of border crossers with whom I feel at home, which is not the usual thing for borderlander. And I think Czesław Miłosz would also feel the same. To be at home, he was exile, as you know, he was emigre. But crossing borders can unify people. This to be an experience, life experience, who can build a roof over our heads, like a home. So that's how I felt the whole day yesterday, listening. The presentations of the work, artwork and educational work, literature work of our friends, and feel simply at home. Yeah, I the whole life I have been border crosser, as a wanderer, as a rioter during communist time in Poland. I was in the underground, so always crossing borders with official life, with status quo. But at the end of the 80s, in 1989, I decided, being a leader of avant-garde theater in Poland, to move with my group to far province from the center to the Polish-Lithuanian border. And it's northeastern part of Poland, to establish a center which we called Borderland of Arts, Cultures and Nations. It was just the first step in the new Poland we did with my friends. The first, we understood democracy as decentralization. So the first thing we understood at that time was that we should move out of the center to the peripheries, to the provinces, start new building, new Poland. And the second was to the border, yeah, to the borderland, which in our tradition, in Polish tradition, is a little bit different from borderline. I have always problems in translating our name of our foundation, Pogranicze, into English, and very often it is translated Borderline Foundation. And I am explaining, no, it is Borderland. And what the difference is that we are referring not to the borderline as a line of division between states or nations or cultures, but borderland means the community of different people living together, of different cultures, of different languages, living together. So the borders are inside the community. In borderland, there are no outside borders. In fact, the borders are inside, and you should live with them as an inner part of your life. And you just practice the art or ethos of border crossing, because otherwise the life is impossible, simply unbearable. So it is something what you could not eliminate from your life. Sometimes the state border you just can say that it is end of your world. But in borderland you should cope with borders on the daily life. And maybe it's also something symbolic about us as a human beings, that's my thought after working many years on borderlands, that we are not belonging to just one bank of the river. We used to live on the river banks, but the life we live is impossible to imagine just on the one bank of the river. It's something in us deeply rooted, this kind of curiosity, necessity, deep feeling that we should cross to the other bank, that we not fulfill our life, that we will be not ourselves, just staying the whole life on the one bank of the river. So this is a very important question, because to myself, because working on borderlands, I started on Polish-Lithuanian borderland, but then I was deeply involved in the former Yugoslavia wars, especially in Bosnia, Kosovo, but not only, then in Caucasus, in Indonesia, in different borderlands in the world. And it was sometimes a very painful experience, and I experienced wars across the borders, around the borders, traumatic memories. And people often, being part of the tragedies, ask me, what are you doing? Are you convinced that these building bridges or crossing borders is necessary? Look what happened in Bosnia. Yeah, the people who defended border crossing, who defended Agora, who defended bridging, were losers in this war. Maybe the war in Bosnia was mainly against them. They were the main enemies of Milosevic, Karadzic, and people like that. Not other nation, other nationalists, but people of Agora, people of building bridges, of claiming that we should live together. There were losers of this war, mainly. So the question was, is it right to think after the war, after these experiences, again to build bridges or to think about crossing the river? Maybe you should build a fortress on your own bank and save your life. And that's the solution for our lives. And especially when I work with young people in my borderland center, I ask him what I'm doing. If maybe they will be losers too in their life, following these ideas, these ethos of borderlanders. Is it good for them? And having these kind of questions in mind, I always thought, but what the alternative is? And what about us? Yeah, could we just stand on one bank of the river in this fortress? Is it the way we can fulfill our life, or say that we solve any kind of problem? So this is something in my deep understanding about ourselves, about the nature of human being, just to cross the border. Not erased, because the borderland is not about erasing borders. Sometimes it's impossible, sometimes it's not good, sometimes could work. But I would rather underline this necessity of just crossing borders, yeah, living with borders as community, as society, inside, and develop the craft, the art of crossing them and living with them. Not creating any kind of illusion about erasing them. And it's, of course, it's difficult. I'm coming here from Europe, where we have less and less state borders in the European Union, the state borders disappearing. But you know how many problems we have now with cultural borders, yeah? Angela Merkel, David Cameron said a year ago that multiculturalism in Germany, in Great Britain, collapsed, yeah? Failed. So it means that, you know, eliminating state border doesn't mean that it is the solution, the safe problems. We have more and more inner problems within communities, diverse communities with borders, with the inner borders of our life. So that's maybe my introductory reflection about the borderland. Thank you.
Marcos? Thanks, Krzysztof.
Good afternoon. I'm one of the ones that live in the borderland and one of the ones that has to cross the borderline at least once a week. We were told, and we agree, that we were going to present in 5 minutes a little resemblance of what we do and what we are. And since yesterday, they had to tackle me to make me quiet, and because I spoke for like a half an hour. I tried to do a timeline of what I said yesterday, and I hope you can follow me, because this is going to be a little bit complicated, and then I'll explain the work that I do. In 1948, my father traveled from Jalisco, Mexico, to Tijuana, and then to Los Angeles, California. In 1955, my mom traveled from the same town to Tijuana, Baja California, and then to San Diego. In 1956, my father was expelled from the United States for having a fake identity and being discovered, and put on probation for 5 years. In 1958, he met my mom. In 1960, they got married. In 1961, I'm born. And in 1961, since I was born and my mom had a green card, we both gave my father finally a green card. In 1975, my father decided that since we lived, and I was born in Mexico, because they decided, we got a green card, me, and then eventually my brother. And then my father declined to come and live in the United States when a proposal of law showed up in our spectrum of life. And then so we stayed there. So in 1975, we gave up the green cards and got local passports. In 1982, following the instructions of my family, I graduated from law school in the University of Baja California. And in 1983, I came to the United States as an illegal to work in the construction business. And in 1985, I got through my connections a green card again, legal one. And immediately, I moved back to Tijuana to live. I've been living in Tijuana since. In 1989, I started doing art and still working as a carpenter for quite more time. And in 1999, from 1999 to now, I only do art as a way of life and not only as a work. And in 1997, I did this horse that you can see here in the picture. And the name of the piece is Toying Horse. And it's one of my, I guess, the most iconic pieces that I have done. We only had the chance to present four images, so this is the first. It's a 10-meter high, 33-feet high wooden horse that was sitting on the demarcation line between Mexico and the United States. Actually, the yellow line is the division or the border line between the two countries. And it was there for a year. And the piece was translucent because that's opposite, I guess, as a way of differentiating from the original Trojan horse from Homer. This is a different situation right now. And we all know what we can expect from the other. So the U.S. know what the Mexicans or the Mexican government or the Mexican people want. And we, the Mexicans, we know what the American people or the American government want. And it's now we, instead of hide things, I think we have the tendency to over-inform, to hide things. So that's I never talked that much about this piece because I think it talks by itself. But it was an interesting piece, especially because of me being in a truck full with tools for 17 years, every day from 5 a.m. to maybe 6:30 in the morning, trying to cross that line and reading Art in America and Art Nexus and all of those things. I said, I'm going to make these people pay back. They want to have to see art. We're here. And I put the piece there. And I have had for these many years a lot of beautiful experiences and stories from people that were very young when the parents crossed them in the weekend or whatever to cross to the U.S. and they saw the piece. And I know of a couple of people that dedicated their life now or to become artists. So I think the work did well, not only for that, but for many reasons. That's one of the pieces I'm showing you. And since we are talking about borders, I'm going to present you this other one. There is a piece that I did in 2003 that is called The Multiplication of Bread. A little bit complicated piece, but I decided when I heard that a war between the United States and Afghanistan was starting that I needed to do something about it. And I requested many institutions for an exhibition and no more than 3 months, which is really complicated in the U.S. and in Mexico because everybody have their schedule filled. But I found a place in San Francisco. It's called Intersection for the Arts, who gave me the chance to put it together. And what you see there is a light box of a young kid around 12 years old that is in a light box with a text like a Schnellen chart that has got a quotation from Dr. Martin Luther King. And in the other side, like in relation with the box, there's another light box with a text written in Farsi in the eyes of an Afghanian lady, baby girl, about the same age. And they want to see the other. But in the same level of their eyes is this cordon of breads that are like in shapes of bombs. And they are coming from like the fuselage of a plane, and they are raining in between. What you see in the bottom is a carpet, an oriental carpet, like a Middle Eastern carpet, and it's a maquette or a model of Kabul. So there's these two kids trying to reach the other one and greet the other one, and there's a different language in the other side. That's hard enough. But when you put more things in between, like misery, hunger, violence, war, it makes it really, really, really complicated. The reason of the carpet behind, underneath, is because the policy of the American government and also the Russian government, when they invade places like Afghanistan, is there is nothing there. And they ignore that there's 5,000 years of culture there with music, with food, with language, with a lot of different customs. So that's this piece. This is the image that I told you. It's the text. I never translate the text, but the text for the public, because I want to keep it like that. Because what we have is a strong problem with not knowing what the other language says, and then we assume that it says something against us or is threatening us. But this is a part of the Quran that is very similar to the quotation of Dr. Martin Luther King. Mm. So it's Islamic love, and then the other one is Christian love. So it says, man must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. The most dangerous word, because nobody wants, in the art world, love is a word that nobody wants to use. I don't know why. And so this is the last image I'm showing you. But one thing that is important to clarify is that the kid there, the American kid that I used for the photograph, is my nephew. His mother is American. His father is Mexican. The one with the green eyes is his father, not the mother. And the lady is also Mexican. She's 12% Lebanese. I don't know how they come up with the 12%. That's what they told me. So I continue to live in Tijuana, and I continue to work many, many projects. But we don't have the time. There's many of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marcos. I'm going to advance the slide ones.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. So if we could go to the first slide. I'll do it then. Yes, okay. So when I was growing up here in Los Angeles, one of my favorite radio stations was this one, the Mighty 690, which meant that I spent most of my growing up years with an ear to the radio, listening to English language, new wave music from England and punk from England and Los Angeles in the US, on a radio station that in between songs, you would hear things like this. Which is to say, I was listening to music that I thought of as my own, as music that belonged to Los Angeles, that belonged to my experience growing up as a white Jewish kid in West Los Angeles, and the voice telling me what my music was in Spanish, coming from Baja California, Mexico, through a border blaster radio station left over from the 1950s that was still broadcasting throughout the 1980s. And it was through that voice that automatically and unknowingly, in a certain way, connected me to this landscape that I had yet to visit. I'd never been to Baja, hadn't been to Tijuana yet, yet somehow I knew I was connected to it because this voice kept connecting me, kept telling me, and making connections for me between, again, songs that I thought of as my own, with a place that I had never been to. And in the years since, I have traveled repeatedly to the border, to Baja California, Tijuana. My work has focused on Tijuana and on Baja. My life has become focused there. My family is now there. My wife is from there. My first child will be connected to Tijuana and Baja California. And the more I go back, the more I think about Baja California through that voice, through music, and through sound. And think a lot about the connection between the Tijuana border that Marcos was just talking to us about and music. In fact, before that border inspection point where his incredible piece was stationed, before it was an inspection point, before it was the most crossed land border in the world, it was actually a bridge in the early part of the 20th century, a rickety wooden bridge that locals called La Marimba, the Marimba Bridge, because of the sound that that the horse-drawn carriages and then eventually the cars would make rattling over the bridge. So the crossing had a sound. The crossing became a kind of musical instrument. And in Tijuana, when people in Tijuana are about to get in line to cross the border, to make that leap to say, I'm going to go and now devote the next hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours of my life to sitting in a car, to cross the border into the United States, or go spend an hour, hour and a half on foot to cross the border. There's one thing you can do. There's actually a number of things you can do to figure out how long your wait will be. And one of them is to turn on various radio stations in Tijuana and do what locals call escuchar la línea, to literally listen to the line, where radio broadcasters will tell you how many cars are in one lane, how many cars in another name, you know, another lane, how many how many people there are to waiting on foot, so that the experience of crossing the border is increasingly an audio one, but it's also one while you're waiting in line in your car. After listening to the line, you hear songs coming from the cars around you. You hear the voices of vendors selling things. You hear people from local orphanages and churches asking for alms. And it's a landscape that is rich. And so I keep coming back to this idea of what do borders sound like. And it goes the other way too, I should say, that the Border Patrol on the U.S. side for years has had a horrific nickname for undocumented Mexican migrants. The nickname is Tongs. And tongs refers to the sound that a Border Patrol's metal flashlight makes when it hits the head of a migrant. So that the language of crossing is music, and the language of and the language of detention is sonic, and they both, there's a kind of shift in frequency that happens that I'm really interested in. And so I keep thinking about the idea of the border as an oral space, a space that we can listen to. And it goes from all the sounds I just mentioned to the U.S.-Mexico border songbook of everything from Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass to Gene Autry to Narco Corridos to a long-standing tradition of U.S.-Mexico border songs and sounds. And one that I wanted to just play for you now is probably actually Marcos's art space, an art studio for a long time was in a neighborhood right next to the pedestrian crossing point. And if you spend enough time in Marcos's studio or in the little mini mall, that's not even a mini mall, it's LA speaking, the space that Marcos was in, it was a soundtrack that was dominated by this sound. The sound of the metallic turnstile as you walk through. I don't know how many times a day you must have heard this. Thousands.
Up to a point that you don't hear anymore, you know?
Right. So borders have sounds, they make noises, and the question, of course, is what do we listen for? And what do we do with the noises and the sounds that we hear? So one of the places that I always look to are, of course, musicians who are making music about this experience, but also sound artists. And I'll just mention two of them really quickly here. One is Richard Lerman, working out of Arizona, who builds razor wire homemade microphones to actually mic border walls and border fences and turn walls and fences into sources of amplification, sound, and noise. This is what one part of the Arizona-Mexico border wall sounds like. It's haunting, it's industrial, carceral. And he's joined also in Arizona by Glenn Wyant, who not only mics the wall, but bows it with a cello bow and turns the Arizona border wall into what he calls a deterritorialized border cello. Gets a certain beauty out of his pieces that kind of troubles me because of how beautiful it is. Last slide. There we go. So I'll just end by kind of trying to maybe broaden out just for a second, which is to say that currently the United Nations estimates that at the present moment there are roughly 200 million migrants moving through the world today. Those 200 million migrants, roughly half of those migrants are women. Are moving across, are in constant motion across a heavily borderized world, a world that's more militarized than ever before. And so I just want to kind of urge us to not only be looking at these borderlands regions, but also listening for them and what it means not just to listen at the border, which is important, but to listen for the edges. Not listening at them, but listening for the edges, and what it means to change the way we do our work, how we lead our lives, if we're listening for the edges and not listening for the centers. Thank you.
Good evening. So I'll start by musing on giving you a little bit of context on how I got to be here, thinking and working in relation to borders and identity. Family. So much comes from the family you come from and the social, political context of that family. So growing up in Tel Aviv, Israel, 3 years after the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, was a situation that I recall of total chaos and no one able to listen to anyone else because everybody's issue or emotional tenure was quite high-pitched. Almost everybody was an immigrant, at least in my surroundings. Including ourselves, the family. And soon learned my mother had 6 or 7 passports in her life, so she was like a roving immigrant. And my father had probably 4 by the time he passed away. So growing up a very high-pitched tenure of the affect of war and the politics of otherness and the internalized politics of borders, I versus you, me versus tu in French. We moved to Canada in 1959, and I learned again that there were some borders crossing there between French and English, Quebec, Montreal, Canada. And again, a culture of quite a bit of adversarial tension. Long story short, after leaving university studying sociology to try to understand difference and otherness, because that was the tenure of my relationship to the world, and realizing that I was only studying others, thinking that I would gather the information of how to help them live their lives better, realizing that that was utterly pretentious, because who the hell was I? So how do you study others when you don't know who you are? And is there a you? Is there an I? I very idealistically, naively went to art school, thinking that artists could ask those questions. Well, we do. And so I will show you a project. Oops. So I don't know how well you can see this on my right. After 2001, 9/11, I became very, very aware of images of conflict and crisis in the newspapers that were being delivered to my home on the weekends. I only got the Sunday LA Times and New York Times. And I started collecting images that compelled me and utterly confused me. One of them was an image of this forensic scientist in Juarez, Mexico, Dr. Irma Rodriguez. And it was cut out of the New York Times in, I think it was late September 2001. A story about Dr. Rodriguez being the chief forensic scientist in Juarez, Mexico, in the middle of the case of, at that time, already 400, 500 missing young women found mutilated in the deserts around Juarez. Victims of kind of the hysteria of global capital and the drug industry, illegal drugs, etc. And I was fascinated by the image of her carving out of oil clay the heads of disappeared people. That was her practice as a forensic scientist, was to sculpt these heads
often from pieces that are remaining of the jaw, and creating it, the identity, recreating the identity from the inside out. Well, I kept this image, and a year later saw this image on the cover of Newsweek magazine, 2002, of two young women, both 17 years old, one a Palestinian Israeli and one a Jewish Israeli, both murdered and disappeared by a bombing in Jerusalem in a marketplace. They were the only two killed, and the bomb was worn by the Palestinian. She was the first female suicide bomber. And I was utterly shocked and utterly compelled by this double portrait of two girls who look very much like each other and could easily fit into my family. I held on to this image for another year and then realized there's a missing image, so I will just, okay, realize that I could ask Dr. Emma Rodriguez in Juarez to forensically sculpt their heads out of clay and bring them back into a likeness, a life likeness. So I worked with a friend of mine who was Spanish-speaking, Ruben Ochoa, and we contacted Irma Rodriguez, who is now in Chihuahua, Mexico. She had left because she was afraid of being killed herself after losing her husband and her daughter. And I sent her the I faxed the image from the cover of Newsweek magazine of the two disappeared girls, thinking she would have empathy and understanding for this another cultural horror story, not a whole lot different in tragedy from the Juarez case. I asked her if she wanted to work with me, and she answered, absolutely. So we went to Chihuahua and lived with her and sculpted these two heads. What was I was very interested in these heads, particularly their eyes. The eyes, the gaze. I took hundreds of photographs of these two heads back in my studio in California. Their gaze would never meet. And this question and this obvious mirroring of the other, mirroring of the enemy, and you cannot see. You cannot see the one that is most like you because you have othered them. And so can no longer see yourself either. So this ended up being an installation at LACMA here in LA. And the last image I wanted to show you was a woman whom I met online, Rula Awad. And last year, 2 years ago, I was invited to Brown University to speak at a symposium on activist theater. And I asked if I could fly myself and Rula out to live in person, with never having met each other, meet each other in front of the audience like you here. And Rula is Palestinian, grew up just 2 miles from where I grew up in Tel Aviv, born. But we never knew each other, and of course, she lived a very different life than I did because of the state of occupation in Israel. So it was my way of bringing a life subject of division and borders in front of people, and just listening to two human beings talking to each other. I do this a lot now because I'm also a mediator. I went back to school and got a degree in conflict resolution. So we'll have a lot more to say about that later. Thank you.
You're all being really good about time.
Oops.
Welcome.
Thanks, Louise and Chris, for gathering us here tonight. I'm honored to be on a panel with kindred spirits regarding our grand theme. I just keep on hearing ideas and experiences that resonate so much with my own. I grew up here in Los Angeles. I'm the son and grandson of immigrants. My mother was born and raised in El Salvador and came here as a young adult. My father was born in here in Los Angeles and was raised partly in Mexico and partly here in Los Angeles. And my childhood was spent crossing several borders, most often the one at Tijuana, but also from Southern California, Baja California, to Mexico City, en route to Central America, to my mother's old country, El Salvador, and the extended family that I had down there. And those borders were in our house and in our social sphere here in Los Angeles, long before people knew who El Salvador was. You know, I'm talking about the 60s and 70s, before the war. My mother married, was part of this fledgling little kind of like lower middle class emigre flow out of El Salvador into the United States, and they were women mostly, and whose families saw the future as being marrying Americans, and more specifically, marrying Anglo-Americans. And my mother fulfilled marrying an American, but she married a Mexican-American, which kind of disappointed my grandmother a little bit. He was not a doctor or a lawyer. He worked in a litho shop in Hollywood. But still, we qualified as middle class back then, when union jobs could get you into the middle class. And the border crossing occurred in our house organically. We didn't call it border crossing, but there was all these informal DJs in our household, you know, just spinning up stuff at our gatherings, which happened to include this social milieu of Mexican-Americans, of Salvadorans, and of Americans, because my mother did have a lot of friends who did marry Anglo-Americans. And so I'm talking about, you know, my generation here, talking about my generation, of the DJs, the informal DJs spinning from Creedence Clearwater Revival, Proud Mary, segueing into the merengue hit of all time, La Negra, and back to a cumbia, and back to, you know, Santana, and back and forth, and at these parties, and my parents were wonderful party parents, and they had kids young, you know, in their early 20s, and they still, you know, kept on partying even after we were born, and had these wonderful gatherings, and the border crossing occurred on the table as well, the food. You know, there was the tamales, and there was ambrosia. Whatever happened to ambrosia? I don't know what happened to that. It seemed to have lost its way in the 70s. But the foods, the pupusas and the tacos, and, you know, so as soon as I was old enough to be aware of language and difference, I knew that this was a rich tableau to work from. Because I would get laugh line. I would get, you know, the laughter of recognition, or a laugh at, you know, a kind of exotic otherness, maybe sometimes. I like to think it was more laughter of recognition that many of us have been crossing borders all along, and it just hasn't been recognized. And so the border became my shtick. That's what my career as a writer is based on the border. I've been writing about the border incessantly for 25 years. And I'm nowhere near getting to the bottom of it. As a matter of fact, I'm more baffled by it than ever. And right now, in this particular moment, because of what is occurring. Now, this landscape here might not immediately call to mind border. It's the Mojave Desert. But the last 10 years, I've been drawn to the literal borderland, this U.S.-Mexico southwestern borderlands, which just happened to be desert. Whoops, we're going the wrong. There we go. This little diorama hung in my grandparents' house in Silver Lake. My grandparents, my Mexican grandparents, were from desert lands. So early on, my family imagined the desert for me, and the Western, of course, imagined it for me as well. Do I have it up the right way? Yes. Here we go. Now, the desert is at once a pristine place that we go to for wilderness and everything, but the desert that I wound up in, yearning to get back to kind of like that pristine, wonderful wilderness state that I saw in some of our family trips when I was a kid, the more I traveled to the borderlands, the more I came upon scenes like this, which is just beyond the backyard of my mother-in-law's house in Albuquerque. Desert as a place of people who are stumbling through, trying to get through, not making it, losing a lot along the way, shedding stuff, throwing stuff away, dying, bodies in the desert, and ultimately the terrible violence of the last 5-6 years now, a very specific violence, the violence of the U.S.-Mexico drug war, which has now, I feel, consumed the borderland and marked it in a way that completely overwhelms whatever innocence there was to the border that I crossed with my parents on trips to San Felipe, Ensenada, Tijuana, Husong's Cantina. You know, the border, what is it called, the road race, the Baja 500 or 1000?
Both.
Rosarito Beach, the Rosarito Beach Hotel. That innocence is completely gone. And also, on this side of the border, in the economic crisis, this is more and more what we see. There's a boutique desert out there, high-end desert. You can go to Joshua Tree today and spend $500 a night for a very smart, modernist, sleek-lined experience in a desert chalet. But more and more of the borderland on this side is this, is the broken dream, is the detritus of the boom. And so, in the context of our conversation, I landed in this desert, which is a broken place right now, which is a place where there are a lot of bodies. It is haunted. It is horrific because of the mutilations of the bodies that are out there, and what happens to the bodies. And it just makes me think that this border that could be this experience of becoming, of communing and becoming with the other, has, at least on our borderline here at the U.S.-Mexico border, become this this terrible zone of violence, of otherness and capitalism gone awry. And I'm going to be continuing to write about the border. I feel like I can't turn away from this border, no matter how much I want to avert my gaze from its pain.
Thank you, Ruben. Yeah, we're good.
Ulupagin the Bochi, Matia Sahaba Jum, and then Nakokia Chiwa Ia, Montreal. Hawum, Ditam, Matia, Tajun, Yikabam Chiditam, or Baka, or Damik, Chukshin. Monan komas hai chukyak chukshin ek wus god na ma wujin. Nan komas ha mach ka ma wujin. And the wufuk bo chim and tukamoy ha chik tomo yao tziki kam iya. Hukamot nan komas ha mach kam hukyoy oot nam hukyoy oob mo iya o tzi ha chuwitika. Tukamoy ha chik tanopi humo muich bi yu hai chuk. Damjidabapo chim and yasapin tatamatabin yuwai itam mantramo yao jiwa. I begin with acknowledging, of course, the hosts, the people of this land, this part of California, the state of California, the indigenous people, some of them who are visible, many who are not any longer. Of course, to thank, you know, our wonderful hosts for the last day, last 2 days of discussion. And as we said, I'm a member of the Odom Nation, also known as the Tohono O'odham Nation in southern Arizona. And our name, Tohono O'odham, the first part of it, Tohono, just means desert. You can look it up in the dictionary and it'll say desert, desert land. O'odham, like many indigenous people, means the people, so we call ourselves desert people. And that distinguishes us from another group, our cousins who are Akimur O'odham, and they are the river people, because they lived along a river. Of course, it's a river that no longer runs. So, and also in southern Arizona, they're still there as well. The Tohono O'odham Nation If you look on the map of Arizona, the reservation, the political boundary of the reservation on the southern end is the U.S.-Mexico border. The Autumn Nation as a culture, as a linguistic group, extends into what is now Sonora, Mexico. That was always our homeland, and it still is. The majority of the Autumn live in Arizona. There's still a great number, though, that live in what is now Sonora, Mexico. And many of our families are split by that border. It's not a big border. It's not a loud border. It's not an intimidating border if you look at it, because that desert land down there is quite desolate. And right now, our nation is struggling to sort of come to grasp with the idea of putting up the wall, as they call it, down there. And those of you familiar with Arizona politics, you know that it's pretty ugly with the border and others. The Autumn people fall into a distinct situation because of that border going through the land there. And yesterday I shared my story and of our family, because my family homeland is on what is now Sonora, Mexico. And but besides that, well, at least I told them that when we crossed the border, it was to go home, not to cross a border just to be crossing a border. It was just to go home. And now it has become very, of course, political. It's a scary place. It's a dangerous place, that whole stretch there. And also, since 9/11, we've had, of course, more issues because of that border. And one thing that happens with many Autumn people is that many people were, of course, you know, being from very rural places, as most reservations are still rural. People were born at home, and they do not have a history of keeping records of who was born, where and when and what date and so forth. And like I said, especially after 9/11, that became an urgent matter for many of our tribal members to try and show any kind of evidence that they were born, first of all, which we've been joking about for the last couple of days, but that they were born in the United States or that they were born in Arizona. And what I'm going to do is share two poems with you. The first poem was just a short poem, and I told them the story yesterday about my own experience of having to get on an airplane, the first time I had to get on an airplane after 9/11. Because I don't have enough information to say that I am, documentation to say that I'm a U.S. citizen and that they should let me get on the plane and let me come back home again from wherever I need to return. And I've been struggling with that. But anyway, the first time I did have to get on the airplane after 9/11, they look at you more closely, not only because of the documentation issue, but of course at that time, just because of the way you look. And so for me, for Autumn people, we've been Catholics for a long time, but we have our own Catholicism that we've mixed along the way. And then we have our own religion still, our own ritual, our own ceremony. So I practice both of them, and I believe in both of them, and I believe that they work for me as I am still here. So anyway, so I took advantage of all of those heavy-duty belief systems when I flew that first time. And so this is that little poem. It's very short, and I'm sure some of you might fall in that same category. And it's just called Crossing Mountains. I am ready, my bundle, my power bundle, hidden but present. My rosary is in the side pocket of my purse, strung around sticks of gum, the pin from the last hotel I stayed in. The beads are poised to Hail Mary. So I was ready with that. As I told these guys, it's now part of my regular luggage, part of my packing process. Those must be there. This other one is the story of many Oodham people and that whole idea, as I mentioned already, about having evidence. And in this case, I said it was having a witness of you having been born. And that is what they want when you are applying for a passport. They need to have some verification in print, in writing, that you were born, that somebody saw you. All of these guys want to be my witnesses that I was born. Anyway, this piece is called Birth Witness. My mother gave birth to me in an old wooden row house in the cotton fields. She remembers it was windy around 1 in the afternoon. The tin roof rattled, a piece uplifted from the wooden frame. It quivered and flapped as she gave birth. She knew it was March, a windy afternoon in the cotton fields of Arizona. She also used to say that I was baptized standing up. It doesn't count, the woman behind the glass window tells me, if you were not baptized the same year you were born. The baptismal certificate cannot be used to verify your birth. You need affidavits, she said. Your older siblings, you have some, don't you? They have to be old enough to have a memory of your birth. Can they vouch for you? Who was there to witness my birth? Who was there with my mother? Was it my big sister? Would my mother have let a teenager watch her giving birth? Was it my father? I can imagine my father assisting her with her babies, my aunts. Who was there when I breathed my first breath, took in those dry particles from the cotton fields? Who knew then I would need witnesses of my birth? The stars were there in the sky, the wind was there, the sun was there, the pollen of spring was floating and sensed me being born. They are silent witnesses. They do not know of affidavits. They simply know. You need records, she said. Are there doctor's receipts from when you were a baby? Didn't your parents have a family Bible, you know, where births are recorded? Were there letters, announcements of your birth? I don't bother to explain. My parents are illiterate in the English language. What I really want to tell her is they speak a language much too civil for writing. It is a language useful for pulling memory from the depths of the earth. It is useful for praying with the sky and the earth. It is useful for singing songs that pull down the clouds. It is useful for calling rain. It is useful for speeches and incantations that pull sickness from the minds and bodies of believers. It is a language too civil for writing. It is too civil for writing minor things like my birth. This is what I really want to tell her. But I don't. Instead, I take the forms from her hands and I begin to account for myself. Thank you.
Thank you all and for bringing these stories to light. We're going to open to questions first among ourselves and then we'll include you. Anyone want to jump in from our end with a question for one of your fellow panelists?
Yes.
Ruben, take it away.
We knew that was going to be me. Luis was, And I want to ask a question of all my colleagues, but given the profound and moving poem that you just shared with us, Ophelia, I wanted to ask you about your homeland, which Chris mentioned the idea of home in the excerpt from the Borderland essay, which is a profound, critical, and lyrical essay that we all read before we gathered. And one of the lines in the excerpt was, anyone who lives in a border zone thinks more about crossing it than about going back home, which caused quite a bit of discussion amongst us, because I think we all come at it from different places. With the nation, the whole idea of home has become so complicated now. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if... I want to believe that there's a way that we can get that the Tohono O'odham nation can get back to the homeland where that border was just desert, mm-hmm. not the scary desert.
Right.
Do you see it?
I think sometimes, even though, of course, the Tohono O'odham nation, like all nations in the United States, you know, they have this sort of category they fit in. They're supposedly sovereign. They have certain power. Just, you know, they have a relationship with the federal government in a way that no other entity in this country does. But at the same time, even though they are a sovereign nation, they still have to go before Congress for permissions, for little things and sometimes big things. And this border, because it is an international place, I think for some reason it is just bigger than what the nation can address on their own. It has to have the whole country. It has to have the United States behind it in order to do anything. And so far, it just has not worked out in that way. And so we struggle with it as a small population, but yet as a very distinct and in other ways very powerful nation. The whole situation is just, I think, just too big, just a huge thing to try and deal with as a indigenous nation.
It's an incredibly powerful symbol. I was drawn to visit the nation on several occasions precisely because it seemed to symbolize the borderless place, mm-hmm. and now, mm-hmm. for the moment, it's not.
Mm-hmm. So, Chris, when you hear these stories, I mean, you hear about the suffering in these places, and obviously, you've gone into places of, you know, great suffering, and yet this kind of vision, you know, of the borderlands as this tolerant place. I mean, it's like this shining, you know, something to aspire to, and sort of like, we were talking yesterday about this dichotomy between like this ugly reality here, and it's almost like, how do you keep your spirits up in, you know, in this situation, which is so literally dispiriting, you know, and that you've visited many of these kinds of places.
Right. And it's difficult, of course, to have one answer to that, but I think something what I may say is like a movement of permanent movement forward is a solution, not to be stuck in dead water and just to think about next step, about, you know, I remember the situation in Bosnia, in Mostar. There's a city built around the bridge, the Mostari, the bridge builders in the old language there, and of course during the wars they destroyed all the bridges across Neretva River, including this beautiful old bridge, Stara Chupria, the famous Mostar Bridge. And the first thing they did after the war, both communities on both banks of the river, Croats and Muslims, was to think about how to rebuild the bridge. Even having these bad memories and hatredness and all aggression around that, there's no way to live without the bridge. So to see, and of course, you know, to destroy the bridge is just a moment. Yeah, you can do it overnight. To rebuild it, it takes years, and that's also the truth about this situation. But it's something like to believe that the movement is possible. Till the moment the movement is possible, the good things are possible too. That you are not confronting with a steel wall without any chance to find a door till that. So that's about the borderland situation, is very much about continuity, about thinking about next step, next day, not stuck with memories, with your truths, with your experience, not to make it fundamental or absolute, but just to, without any ideology, and just to think about next steps is something.
Like a Trojan horse, perhaps.
Right.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I remember, and my sister's in the audience, so she'll probably remember this too, or maybe even be embarrassed that I'm sharing this, but having growing up, and we each did in our own ways, with a kind of an interior, our psychic beings get formed around suffering or impossibility of crossing, or even hysteria or impossibility or neglect, suppression, repression, histories that don't want to be excavated. We all grow up with this interior landscape, and so the borders are also within. And I don't know where this came into my head, but at age 7, I dragged my sister into the bathroom in my family's house, apartment, because it was the only place we could close the door and have privacy. And I said to her, "Johanna, we're going to make a blood oath, okay? And if you scream, you're really going to get it." She just sat there and said, "Okay." I said, "I'm going to take a needle and I'm going to prick your little finger and little blood's going to come out. It'll hurt just for a second." She says, "Okay." She didn't even ask me what for. But my purpose was to make an oath with myself and to pull her into it so she would remember this, that we will never be like them. The them around us, not just the local family, but the hysteria that was, fostered by hysterical politics all around us. And we pricked our fingers and did our little blood oath. And I don't know what moved me to do that. It was probably, I have no idea. I mean, when you ask that question, where does willfulness come from? Or where does the creative or inspired urge come from? I think we can answer that, but we have to look for it. And I know also that in the 90s, when I was very desolate over the collapse around the National Endowment for the Arts and the how artists were pushed into the corner and accused of vile acts of prurient interest and et cetera, et cetera, and condemned in a sense of not moving from integrity or thoughtfulness, but out of utter shameful expression. I really was hurt by that. And I lost a lot of commissions for my work after that congressional shutdown. And I asked the question, so what am I going to do now? And why, what am I going to do with my creative urges? You know, they're there. I don't know where they come from, but I have them. And I started working with the homeless children. And I didn't understand why, what compelled me to work with them, homeless teenagers who had the willfulness to leave their circumstance of abuse and show up at this crisis center and just hang out and have a meal and be tutored and be nurtured. And I realized after hanging out with them for about 6 months how highly creative they were, because they had that impulse to leave the utter destructive suffering and the living within this interiorized victimization.
It's amazing. Well, look, yeah, go ahead.
If I may have a question to Marcos, it's my neighbor, and you know, it's a crucial thing in the borderlands to deal with your neighbor. Good. Well, of course, hearing them, you understand me that I have many questions, but also the first thing which appears to my mind when we just started our conversation yesterday was how to continue it. Yeah, what will be our next step as this border crossers meeting, and how I can bring them to Poland, to my small kingdom of borderland, and continue this what we started, you know, here, and imagining Marcus coming to my borderland, and imagining my old dreams that we can build an installation of the bridge, which will say something about this kind of work and practice. I immediately started to think what Marcos could do. What Marcos would be your bridge?
Don't forget that before you told me or talked to me about this, we all were discussing how are we going to take Ophelia with us.
Yes. This was first.
I already started like thinking in somebody that can get us a passport or something. But the thing is, the most amazing thing is that I'm gonna risk it here saying it, but I cannot think of anybody more American than her and then she in this room, and she's the one that cannot leave the country.
Maybe we should create even go to Mexico. A movement. Mm-hmm. Of witnesses of Ophelia's birth.
Yes, my witness. <Yeah. laughs>
But after we solve that, because we will, mm-hmm. I can get you a Mexican passport. Oh,
no. I know I can get you an Israeli one.
But I was thinking like we were just mentioning about the possibility of making an installation there and then making a bridge, since that resonates more than. Maybe than a horse, because a horse has some kind of belligerence and conflict in within, you know. But it can be many ways, you know. It can be a twisted bridge that barely touches the one. Can be an overlap bridge. Can be a bridge that it doesn't touch the other side. You have to jump. Can be a very well finished bridge or a rough one. But just going there.
Will it have a turnstile? Will it have a turnstile that makes noise?
No, but we can bring the sound that Josh already recorded. I have also a story, because everybody's telling stories, you know.
And, a question, but we need questions.
Yeah, we need questions. And a brief story, a little one, and that exemplifies what it is living in a place like Tijuana and all these things that and the dates that I mentioned to you. Long time ago, when I was an illegal in the United States, one of my compadres came from Jalisco, Mexico, and we went to a very fancy neighborhood in Chula Vista, California, and Bonita, California, and we were driving. I was driving a station wagon with no shock absorbers in the back. And my compadre was wearing a big Mexican hat like this. And a zarape. And we were stopped by the cops, you know, and then we were asked immediately for our papers. So my compadre was the guilty looking one, you know, like the one the menacing one. So when he was asked, he turned to me and said, "What is he saying? ¿Qué dice?" "Oh, your passport." He pulled his passport and he grabbed his wallet and brought out his card as a dentist, Mexican passport. So he was clear. Then the officer asked me for my driver's license, and I had a driver's license since I had a social security when I was born. I got one. And I show the license, and then When he stopped us, he called INS immediately because of the suspicious looking of my friend. But when the INS officer arrived, the one that was perfectly clear was him. And I was in trouble because I had driver's license with an address of Chula Vista, California, and I had no green card, no American passport. So the lady, an African-American lady, amazingly tall and big, it seems to me like infinite, you know, like very tall. She asked me, what is your citizenship? And I had to lie. Not that I like to lie a lot, but I had to lie. And I said, I am an American citizen. And she said, you're not. No, you're not. And yes, yes, I am. No, no, you're not. I have my local passport hidden in my back pocket. And she says, since you cannot prove, I'm going to take you with me. So that was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life, and the most terrible ones too. Because I was in the back of a van of the INS for the whole day, since like 9:30 in the morning. And I went to El Centro. I went everywhere. I follow all the routes that this lady follow. And they translated people from all over Mexico and Central America from my van to another van and whatever. That was an experience, a very terrible experience in a way. Made me deal with these subjects about the border. There was this pregnant woman from Oaxaca that was in the truck with me, and she was very thirsty. And there was this lady with this big gulp from 7-Eleven, like going like this, hitting the ice cubes to the sides. And I asked her, you know, can you give water to this poor lady here? And she said, no, I'm not allowed. She finished the thing making this horrible sound. And then she asked again, can I have the ice cubes? And I asked her, can she have the ice cubes? And she says, no, I'm not allowed. She hit him again, opened the window, and threw the ice cubes to the door. Then I was dropped eventually. She was moved to another place, and I was dropped in a place in San Isidro, California, which had a big window with window guards from which I could look my neighborhood like a mile and a half away. And I was trapped there for like another 4 hours until an officer came and called me, and they took me to an officer that was, last name was Aguirre, I remember. And he asked me, what happened today? I explained him everything, and he says, well, you said that you were a U.S. citizen. Why you said that? And I started telling him all these stories that my father told me about being owners of half of the American territory now that used to belong to Mexico. And that I was born right there at the border, and that I can move back and forward all the time whenever I want, and this and that and that. He waited for me, and when I finished, he said, you know, I'm going to let you go home, which seems strange to me. And because your father was here just a half an hour away, ago, and he told me the same story that you told me. I should throw him in jail instead of you. But don't ever repeat this story, in especially not in front of a judge, because this is called sedition. And here is your papers. Put your fingerprints, please, over here, and you're free to go. And that really made me think very strongly what is to live in a border. Still, I agree with him. We need to have hope. I don't know how many of you ever have been in Mexico. Can you raise your hand?
Let's open up. We have the house lights up, and we'll bring the microphones out. How many have been to Mexico in this room? So there you go. There you go. And do we have some questions from the audience? We'll have a little time here before we move out to the reception.
I'd like everybody to raise their hand who was born somewhere else, because I was born in Canada.
Okay. Oh, you got a showing.
Yeah,
sure. I was born somewhere. Mm-hmm.
New Jersey, yeah, okay.
A couple decades ago, a friend of mine was exploring edges and borders and stuff in her art and painting. And you know, it was a great conversation that we had. It went on for days, it seemed like. And it was really about the acknowledgement that in civilization and in nature and everywhere, we find the edges of everything. Everything is edges. We are actually, as an audience, we're a friendly crowd. But if we were an unfriendly crowd, you'd be very glad about that edge of tables you have in front of you and the edge of the stage. And we don't worry about edges. Edges is just something that's there, right?
Do you have a question, too?
Yeah, I want to sort of create the image first that is that edges are not the problem. Borders are not the problem. It's what civilization has done to it. I wouldn't be worried about the edge of that stage unless there were a toddler walking there. Then I would want to control it. I would want to control that border for that particular type of person. But we're trying to control borders of everything. And I'm wondering if, do you see the problem that she mentions a language that she comes from where it's so civil that it can't be owned by civilization in reality? Mm-hmm. And it seems like civilization, as it creates beauty, also is like this boa constrictor.
Can you try and just give us, just because we want to have other people ask questions.
Right,
too.
But I want to speak to this because it's
a
fairly big concept. Is that civilization is sort of swallowing everything that is just normal. And I wonder if anybody would like to talk to that. Is civilization a positive? Is 21st century civilization going in a good direction or a bad direction?
Mm-hmm. It's pretty general. Anyone want to take that on? Or should we let it sit there? Go,
if my, I may say about civilization in a very practical way, what you describe at the beginning between the division between audience and performers. Yeah, because I believe it very much consists the culture we live in, you know, and for me, and it creates civilization also. So I believe in civilization which you are shaping somehow, not you are shaped by, but you are just part of shaping it. And what is very close to me, you know, we had once a very, very interesting theater director, Jerzy Grotowski, who had the same question you raised at the beginning. And he was thinking how to abandon this border between audience and performance and make you creators. You audience, yeah, to make a common space for doing things, creative things together. He called it active culture. At that time, it was possible only in Poland, you know, in islands, in separate islands. And for me, for my generation, for my Borderland Center, it became crucial question after 1989. Could we make culture, active culture, in the local communities, abandoning this border between artists, creators, and just people, yeah, making them being. That's maybe about the democracy. If we are talking about civilization, let's say about democracy as participation, as something what makes people creative and responsible, co-responsible for doing things. So coming back to building bridges, yeah, coming back to crossing borders, I can't imagine the culture which will be efficient without participation, without, you know, abandoning this border between just spectator and doer, yeah, that we should make people doing it, yeah, we should make them shaping
it. I totally agree. I just want to add, the problem's not civilization. Civilization is inevitable. We're human species and we create community and civilization is just a maturation of community. The problem is when we forget that civilization are only people and that we're made up of we can either be active or passive. When we become passive, we give up participation in the civilization and then it gets the better of us. So the question more to me is not about civilization, it's about proactivity and how aware are you of yourself, your own bias, your own ability to move forward, to make choices, to be intentional. That, to me, is the question.
Question over there. We're going to have less time for questions than we thought. Go ahead.
No problem, Angela.
Hello. I am interested in the relationship between borders and privilege. So borders are quite fluid and permeable for some people. I mean, globally, just for people from the first world, the developed world. And then for others, it seems that borders are becoming stronger and less penetrable and more meaningful. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts or reactions or experiences relating to borders and privilege in the 21st century.
I mean, I could offer just one example of this, actually, that comes from the Pentagon, which isn't always a good place to look for thinking about these things. As there's a former Pentagon strategist, I don't know, you've done work around this idea yourself, Marcos, a guy by the name of Thomas Barnett, who wrote a book called The Pentagon's New Map, where he talked about how the Pentagon sees the world according to what he calls it the political equator, that the world is basically divided by an equator line that's politically drawn, where on one side of that line is the kind of global world of access and inclusion in the global, in kind of the idea of the global culture. And on the bottom side of that line is what is called the non-integrating gap in government speak. And that political equator lines up geographically with some of the most militarized border checkpoints in the world. So that the kind of the detention of the movement of people from one side of that border to the other is the line that separates global freedoms, issues of social justice, of access to digital technologies, the old kind of have and have not split, updated for a 21st century digital context. So that the privilege that you talk about is more and more intense than ever before, and we still talk about things like the internet or the World Wide Web in these very easy ways, and forget the extent to which that kind of access itself is its own border. And so privilege is something, I mean, we talked about this a lot yesterday, the kind of the privilege of not just who gets to cross, but also I was talking a little bit about the privilege of not having to think about borders, and not have to think about them at all. And then at the same time, thinking about in Tijuana, how the border, we talk about the border as a site of, you know, pain, ruthlessness, and, you know, a place where innocence is, you know, the innocence of the border is gone. And also to remember that on the other side of the borderline in Mexico, the border was also a long, and still in some ways is a site of opportunity, is a site of promise. Cities, you know, like Tijuana are migrant cities, cities where people are continually moving north for promise. So that, you know, borders, it's a shifting vocabulary and a shifting language. And we ended yesterday, I think, with the idea that, you know, the borderlands, or, you know, that we all talk about borders and crossing in such different ways that we have to be so careful about how we talk about them, and so sensitive to the way that they have different meanings in different communities and different contexts.
Just a quick variation on that, too. Everybody raised their hand when you were asked if you've gone to Mexico. Mm-hmm. How many people have gone to Mexico in the last 2 years?
That was the second question that I was wanted to make.
It's about half of the people that raised their hands, or maybe a third. The privilege is one thing, but the sites where the privileged can move to are prescribed by where zones, the conflict zones are, and it just so happens that the U.S.-Mexico border zone is that right now. And the most recent State Department travel warning map is about 65% of Mexican territory. And to flip the equation around is, you know, as you mentioned, you know, the numbers of migrants globally is to see, yeah, you know, passport can get you onto a plane and, you know, transcontinental flight. But there's so much agency among migrants who cross the borders without those documents. Post 9/11, it is a different map, but there's still a tremendous amount of movement going on. Right now, crossing the border are several hundred people, right as we speak, and that's not going to change anytime soon. And the wall has not had the impact that the proponents of it have sought. So there's always a river that gets across the wall somehow.
Yeah, and there's one element that is like very important here that make you or make you not go places, which is the element of fear. Fear, but it's been in a very unequal world. The ones below that political equator, they also feel fear, and then most certainly they can have more chance to die while trying to cross to the United States than you going to CHOP and Revolution Avenue the next weekend. But more than half of the people that raised their hand at the beginning didn't raise it again because they feel fear. But the people in Mexico, the one to be part of the privileged ones, they need to come and they need to cross. And we build the bridges, we hide in trunks of cars, and we come through tunnels, not only from the gates. That's always money, privilege, and dreams will make people travel and try to find a better horizon. That's not going to change. But we are hoping to make it more even.
I think we're going to stop close to now. Krzysztof, do you want to make a last statement before we adjourn? We'll read another Miłosz poem at the... Thanks to the Consul General, we're going to open up the reception and announce the Miłosz poem that's going to go on the buses all over Los Angeles. But Krzysztof, would you like to make a closing statement?
Yeah. We were planning to present you the Czesław Miłosz poem, which is not time for, but just hearing all the discussion, I want to say you to share with you my deep feeling and gratefulness for being here on American-Mexico borderland. And you always can learn a lot. And you the very positive energy is that you meet people who don't agree or disagree with the situation it is with the border, so which is already the crossing, you know, that when you disagree and you are in the move somehow. So I deeply admire the work. I got to know thanks to these meetings and thanks to Luis' efforts to gather us. And my always and only response to that is to think how I can arrange the next step, and I'm sure that we will meet in Polish-Lithuanian borderland again.
That'd be great.
As a next step, with more and thinking about co-production, about doing things together. I know that I will translate Ophelia poems into Polish. I don't know yet how I will take them to Poland, to her, her to Poland. But I hope you will help, and we will make an Ophelia case.
Well, thank you for traveling, all of you, from near and far, especially Chris, from so far. And in lieu of going to the Polish-Lithuanian border, I invite you all, on behalf of the Polish Consul General, to join us for Polish-Lithuanian and, I think, Tijuana, or Polish-Lithuanian cuisine. In the courtyard. Thank you so much. Allowed is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Allowed theme was composed by Larry Karish.